on this special episode of I'm Not a Lawyer, But the Debrief.
I know what didn't happen.
Okay. Oh, I like it.
There is no evidence that shows Karen Reed struck John O'Keefe with her vehicle.
Yeah.
Okay.
We talked about this early on. It's worthy of repeating. A 7,300-pound vehicle, as testified by Trooper Paul, did not impact John O'Keefe in that there are no additional signs of trauma to his body. Mm-hmm. Bruising, fractures, broken bones, all absent. The injury that may have been a part of expiring is the gash to the back of the head. Could that have happened from falling in the pavement? It was asked by Attorney Yannetti today. Would it be possible to be punched in the face, knocked out before you hit the ground, and your head impacting the ground to create that type of damage? And the medical examiner said it's possible.
Now, if you're not ready, then go ahead and tell me you're not ready.
I object to you getting records. You've been intrusive into people's personal lives.
In other words, the car didn't hit him, and he wasn't hit by the car.
I'm not a lawyer, but...
Are y'all keeping up?
Debrief.
Hello and welcome to a special episode of I'm Not a Lawyer, But
the Debrief.
I am Melanie, aka I'm Not a Lawyer, But, and I'm joined by my co-host
Gooseberry. How y'all doing?
And we are so excited because, as you know, we have been following the Karen Reed trial every day.
Yes.
Because we are captivated by every part of it. And so we are so excited because we have a special guest joining us today. I'll tell you a little bit about him and then we can welcome him to the podcast. So his name is Todd McGee. He is a retired Massachusetts State Police trooper. You heard that part right. He worked for 24 years in law enforcement before retiring. And now he runs his own business, 508 Group, which is a security consulting firm. He is well respected in this space in when it comes to violent extremism, proactive threat mitigation, and more. And we are so, so, so excited to have him join us to talk about the Karen Reed case, to give his perspective and all of that. So thank you so much for being here. So excited to dig into this.
Yes, nice to have you on.
Thank you for having me and look forward to our conversation.
Absolutely. So let's kick it off. Let's dive in. Can you tell us, first of all, you can give us a little bit of context kind of to that intro as far as like what you did when you worked in law enforcement, what that looks like. And then we can kind of connect that to the Karen Reed trial and some of the characters or witnesses that we've seen come to the witness stand for that.
Absolutely. So I started my law enforcement career in 1987. And I was assigned to various units and divisions within the Department of State Police. Our department here in Massachusetts is the largest public safety agency within the Commonwealth. And during my career, I had worked accident reconstruction. I had worked at various barracks, which meant working the highway patrol. I was assigned to the arsons, to the fire marshal's office for arson investigation. And with that, we responded to fire scenes as well, from dumpster fires to commercial seven-figure, 10-figure dollar loss types of conflagrations. Also, my last 10 years of my career was at Logan International Airport after the 9/11 attacks. So I spent the last 10 years relearning how to protect critical infrastructure. At the time, we had about 27 million traveling passengers during the course of a calendar year. So we really need to rethink about aviation security and how to protect our infrastructure, as well as the tenants, contractors, and employees, as well as the traveling public. I retired in 2011, where I've been consulting full-time. I work with businesses, nonprofits, schools, healthcare facilities. I help them develop their physical security, as well as their emergency management procedures. And I work very closely here in Massachusetts mainstream media with our local news networks, providing law enforcement and security analysis. And lastly, I'll end with, I provide training and education overseas to what we call partner nations to the United States, with the Department of State Office of Anti-Terrorism Assistance. I've developed two courses. One is a counterterrorism course for law enforcement, and the other one is a aviation security program. And we deliver those to partner nations that are looking for support from the United States government.
Wow. Well-rounded.
I would hire you.
Your resume is more extensive than some of the people we've seen on That's Den.
Oh.
Blessed indeed.
Well, thank you for that. So with that, can you give us a little bit of context into how the State Police Department works, particularly in conjunction with some of the town police, because the way it's been put across, if I'm even using the proper terms, but when someone dies outside of the care of a medical professional, state police seem to handle those deaths. Is that accurate?
You have done your homework well. Let me give you context as it relates to the Karen Reed trial.
Okay.
When John O'Keefe's body was discovered in the wee hours of the morning, January 29th, 2022, mm-hmm. Canton Police Department was called out. John O'Keefe was found still alive. He had not expired at the discovery of his body. So to your earlier point, that does not trigger the statutory requirement for the state police to come out to investigate an unattended body, is what we would call it.
Okay. You said unattended body?
Unattended body.
Okay.
So in this particular case, John O'Keefe's body is found in proximity on the front lawn of the address of the mm-hmm. of the Albert family. He's transported. He's thought to be in a condition where he could be resuscitated. CPR was conducted on him, and also they tried to deal with the hypothermia that he was experiencing. Mm-hmm. And so this period of time is elapsing. Now let's bring it back to the property. There was a crime scene that was established by Canton Police Department for approximately 2.5 hours.
Mm-hmm.
In this simultaneous time, the Canton Police Department lifted the crime scene. And then at that point, or some point thereafter, John O'Keefe passes. And then that triggers the statutory requirement that you opened up this question on for the state uh-huh. police to now come out and investigate.
Got it.
That's the first hole in the investigation.
Mm.
Because now you have a crime scene that is not what we call sterile.
Uh-huh.
The whole idea for this investigation, it's frustrating as a former investigator.
Mm-hmm.
All they had to do was slow things down.
Mm.
Slow things down, secure the crime scene. In this particular case, it was the property of the homeowners. You're not talking about a large, vast area.
Yeah.
In this particular case, you could have preserved the crime scene. And I know you have other questions, so I don't want to get too far down the road in my description. But preserving the crime scene was the first and most important aspect. And that played out later because of the tail lens collection of evidence and mm-hmm. this question of when did it come into evidence and is it admissible based mm-hmm. on the timing of it being collected and presented, not to mention the chain of custody with the evidence that was collected.
Yeah. Is there, maybe the answer is no, but is there, talking about the crime scene being lifted and then dedicating two and a half hours and then saying, okay, we're done here. Should it have, or what is typical for that? Should it have stayed until John O'Keefe was in a condition in which we know he's going to survive, or we know like he has passed away? Like, is there a typical time frame? Like a crime scene should be preserved, or is there a certain situation or indication that happens like in a case that is now like, okay, we are good to lift this now?
Every crime scene, every incident is fluid. However, you had EMT response and transport of John O'Keefe, and they were trying to revive him and get him back to some level of stable condition. So my thought would be Canton Police Department would have state police on standby mm-hmm. if he does indeed pass away.
Mm-hmm.
But in the meanwhile, if his condition doesn't improve, and it was obvious that he was unconscious mm-hmm. at the time of transport, again, let's just slow things down in case he does pass away. We need to get state police out to the crime scene for a proper investigation and a proper collection of evidence. You probably saw in your research that Kent Police Department collected blood samples and put them in plastic Solo drinking cups.
Yes.
Wrong.
Yeah.
That was my next question.
Absolutely wrong. There are proper procedures where the blood samples will go into some type of a container and it would be sealed to ensure that there's no cross-contamination. The next thing is the paper bag that was used. Yeah. Evidence collection bags are paper, okay. but they're not from a local grocery store. they're a paper bag mm-hmm. that has never been used and would be considered sterile
yeah.
in order to receive the whatever evidence you're going to collect. Got and it. Then it is to be sealed, stapled, fastened together, taped, but nonetheless sealed and then documented. And I missed a step. Uh-huh. Photograph. So oh. you photograph, you collect, you seal, you document, you transport. Mm-hmm. That's your chain of custody all the way to the crime lab. And then there's a log at the crime lab of the investigator or the officer that is investigating the incident, and all their information is put in there to have a complete log.
Is there a certain way you handle snow though? Because they brought out the blower. I know you have to, you know, like you said, the crime scene is fluid. You're not sure what you're about to be presented with. So is there a way to collect evidence, you know, that's in snow?
Well, I'm not a crime scene specialist, but part of that state police response is not just a detective coming out to take witness statements. We have a whole division, a whole unit that's called Crime Scene Services. Mm-hmm. They're the experts. Mm-hmm. And all they had to do was maybe find some type of an indicator, a flag or a stick or something to say, we believe that there's evidence as part of this incident in this part of the yard. Mm-hmm. And then they could bring the responding state police investigators and then bring that to their attention. Mm-hmm. And then that would have been the right and appropriate step. And then whatever resources they have as far as tools or collection tools to be mm-hmm. able to secure that evidence and then bag it accordingly, that would have been the most appropriate way to be able to collect that evidence.
Got it.
That makes sense.
Got it. You know, we were supposed to start off asking you if you know the Alberts, because everybody in Massachusetts seems to. So we probably should have prefaced that. Do you know them? Do you know any of the people in this case?
Actually, I don't know the Alberts, but Chief Berkowitz, I was his drill instructor when he went through the police academy over 30 years ago.
Really?
Yes.
That is
when you've
wild.
Been in the game a long time, you meet a whole bunch of people. Yeah.
I was being funny, but that answer, I love, this is great.
That's not surprising.
It's not though. I mean, yeah. To the point, you know, you've done this for a long time since, and a lot of these people have as well. So that's 86. Not surprising. That's funny.
Yeah. That's interesting.
So I want to talk about, you mentioned experts, and I want to understand a little bit about the courses and classes that you may take, may be required to take. I'm not sure how it works. When you are a state trooper, what that looks like, and then is it enough, is it sufficient enough to establish you as an expert in that thing, or when are the instances in which you would say, okay, I've exhausted my knowledge and now I need to call in someone else to help me?
That's a great question. Let me start with the State Police, the formal training academy, mm-hmm. which is 6 months in length. And it also includes approximately 1,300 hours of curriculum of all types of different courses, mm-hmm. from crime scene to car, motor vehicle stops, to ethics training, to bias policing, and the like. So just dozens and dozens of courses that equate about 1,300 hours of curriculum. Mm-hmm. After you graduate, there is a 6-month break-in period. So now you ride with what's called a trooper coach, and you'll most likely, in, if you're driving through Massachusetts and you see a state trooper, there's a single trooper, man or woman inside of that cruiser. If you ever see two, most likely the passenger is a newly graduated recruit, and they're going through their break-in process.
Got it.
So that is also part of their learning of all things of working in the capacity of a state trooper.
Got it.
Now, once you are reassigned, you put in for you request a transfer to go in to a particular unit. We'll say it's a detective unit. Those detective units work for the prosecutor's office on the county level. Those troopers will undergo specific training as it relates to the job function of the unit. When I was assigned to the fire marshal's office, one of the best units I was assigned to for training and education.
What was it
one
again?
School sorry. I went to, it was the state fire marshal's office for arson investigation.
Got it.
One of the best training experiences I had was while assigned in that unit. One particular school that I went to was called Bomb Recognition School, and it was hosted by ATF, Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, federal agency. Mm-hmm. I can tell you that within 2 weeks, they trained us in order to recognize bomb parts. They had us building bombs out of pizza boxes, VCR tapes, remote controls, limited to our imagination.
Uh-huh.
And the mindset was to educate you as a technician so that if you ever went to a fire scene where there was an explosion, you know to look at things like foil or anything that can conduct electricity.
Mm-hmm.
And also it's an understanding that things don't disintegrate. Things fall apart, but things like barcodes where someone may have bought PVC pipe at a local big box store and used that as part of their components. That's evidence, right? So it's those particular things that begin to help educate you in order to be a better investigator.
Got it.
So your question about, does that make you an expert? The answer is no. The answer is, even though I spent 2 years in the fire marshal's office, I wouldn't consider myself an expert in cause and origin. I went to over 100 different fire scenes within my time assigned at the unit, which is a lot, but I wouldn't consider myself an expert. I had other coworkers that I worked with that testified in front of judge and jury, grand jury. They made a case law with their Supreme Court case law with their testimony.
Wow.
They have a degree in fire science. Those are the true experts. I would have considered my level as an end user practitioner in that example. Trooper Paul, who was the accident reconstructionist brought on by the Commonwealth, I would consider him an end-use practitioner within the discipline of accident reconstruction. Very, very bad move by the prosecution to bring him on as their expert witness.
Agreed.
That was my next question is, you said you was a reconstruction.
Accident reconstructionist.
Early in my career, yes.
Well, you just expound on what you thought about Trooper Paul, but do you have any suggestions on what could have happened or if the evidence proves he was hit by a vehicle?
Trooper Paul testified under oath that his theory was that Karen Reed accelerated to approximately 24 miles per hour. The vehicle struck John O'Keefe's upper arm, causing him to spin
and
land 30 feet away from point of impact. Let's back that up.
Okay.
A 7,000-pound vehicle, 7,300 to be exact, according to Trooper Paul, striking soft tissue is going to leave broken bones, some type of shattered spine, some type of bruising, and it was absent. The only forensic recognition of any cracked bones provided by this was testimony provided by the medical examiner was consistent with resuscitation, meaning CPR, cracks around the ribs and the sternum.
Yep.
That was the only additional damage as far as trauma, if we separate the head trauma and the bites, what appeared to be bites on the right forearm and, and bicep area. But as far as the vehicle, 7,000-pound vehicle striking John O'Keefe and launching him 30 feet from point of impact, don't see it. Here's the next thing. What's important? So I've testified as an expert witness in use of force. That's my area that I can call myself as an expert based on my length of time and training, based on my certifications, based on testifying in front of judge and jury. And regardless of witness testimony, the medical evidence tells its own story. The medical evidence is going to tell you what happened and what trauma did the body receive.
Makes sense.
It's absent. It doesn't present itself. Yeah. And whether you're pro Karen Reed or pro Commonwealth, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
The medical evidence speaks its own story.
Yeah.
And it's unbiased.
Yeah.
100%.
I totally agree with you.
So in regards to reconstruction, in my mind, I hear reconstructionists and I'm like, okay, y'all going to reconstruction what happened and show that it can happen. So I thought, and maybe I'm wrong, tell me if I'm wrong, I thought we would see some example, even if just digitally, virtually, of a vehicle, 7,000 pound, like the taillight cracking, like the what amount of force would be required to crack a taillight. And the fact that that was never given, I just feel left wanting more. So is it weird or is that crazy to assume that we would have saw some kind of like
experiment?
Yeah. Like, show me how this happened.
So I will share with you, even with 24 years of a law enforcement career, I was very confused when a lot of this evidence was introduced. So I would have envisioned, along with testing or some type of hypothetical testing, I would have thought we would have had more of a timeline, and we would have seen, according to what we know, Karen Reed to be at the house, and when John O'Keefe left the vehicle and he went into the house, from that point for me starts when Karen Reed says, "I'm leaving." She texts John O'Keefe, "I'm leaving." To me, that starts a timeline. So not to mention, you can even go farther back to the time at the waterfall bar where they started the night and then transitioned to the Albert's house. So there's a lot of timelines that are missing. As far as the testing or forensic testing of things, that tail lens, that plastic tail lens, it's thick and it's heavy. And I can go back to my reconstruction days, and at 24 miles per hour, impacting that glass against bodily tissue is not enough for that glass to shatter in the way it was represented.
Right. Yeah.
Could it crack the lens? Yes. But there are also people saying that even at 24 miles per hour, it's not enough to bring a person unconscious or to kill them. It's just not enough speed. Even with the weight of the vehicle, it would be almost more like a heavy push or a heavy impact.
Got it.
And that would be the end result.
Got it.
The other thing I wanted to mention prior in my description, the tail lens that was introduced and then tested at the crime lab, none of it had any of John O'Keefe's tissue or bodily fluids, blood, on the lenses. None of it. So if that's the case, if there's extreme impact, in order for something to shatter, to answer your question, equal and opposing force must exist. Either a telephone pole, another vehicle, something else that's a firm, stable object. Got in it. Order to have a shattering of glass.
Wow.
Cracked glass is a different story, but shattering, the way it was introduced, and the absence of any human DNA on the lens, the prosecution has just created reasonable doubt for the jury.
Say that part again. Say the equal and opposing force. Is that what you said?
In order for that glass to shatter the way that it was represented and introduced in the court of law as evidence, an equal and opposing force could have met Karen Reed's SUV.
Got it.
Either a telephone pole, another vehicle, something that had that substantial weight to have an equal and opposing force, if you will. Doesn't it necessarily have to mean the opposing force has to be moving,
uh-huh.
but it's got to be substantial enough in order to create enough force to create debris in the form of that disintegration of glass.
Yeah.
I just learned something. That was good. That makes sense. I'm excited.
I forgot the officer's name that went to the house with Proctor, and he was the
not Tully or Buchanan.
Supervisor Buchanan.
Buchanan, but there was another one that saw the cracked tail light.
Trooper Paul.
Oh,
was it Trooper Paul? Okay, he said that the tail light was cracked. And it only had a small hole.
Oh, no, you're talking about the Dighton officer.
Dighton
is that
who
you're talking about? The Dighton police officer at Karen Reed's parents' house.
Yes.
He was outside and he got on the stand and he said, I saw it, but it was only cracked.
Yes. His testimony, he basically went to the Karen Reed's house just to assist in the tow, to make sure, really to make sure no issues happened. And the vehicle was hooked, towed, transported, and then... 15 minutes of time. Mm-hmm. His testimony in court, I thought, was extremely credible. Yes. And it was just a matter of fact. He testified as to what he saw.
Yep.
And at best, that tail lens was cracked.
Yep.
Yeah.
And when he spoke, and like you said, matter of factly, I was like, he's telling the truth.
Yeah. Credible.
Yes.
You're just like, I believe him.
Yeah.
100%. I want to go to your thoughts about all of the reasons or lack thereof that was given as to why the officers did not get a search warrant and search 34 Fairview, because according to them, they didn't have probable cause and it was going to be denied. What are your thoughts on that, given the body was on their lawn?
So as an investigator, you are a fact finder. Mm-hmm. That is your job. And if you go back to the early, when the trial started in Canton PD officers, the first responding officers, when they were asked that question, almost to a man, they had said, we didn't have a search warrant. Now the law says that a United States citizen has a greater expectation of privacy within their home as compared to on a sidewalk, as compared to in your motor vehicle. But our expectation of privacy in our home, in our apartment, in our dwelling, we have a greater expectation of privacy. That being said, there's a Boston police officer on your front lawn. If I don't go into the house, I'm still getting those witness interviews. And if I feel that there's something that's awry and there's something that just doesn't make sense, then I'm getting my search warrant and I'm coming back into the house. And I'm going to look for things that I'm either going to look disheveled or I'm looking for things that are overly cleaned. And then I'm going to bring in my resources, like my chemicals, and I'm going to start mm-hmm. sampling and testing for blood. So there could have been a next step with the investigation that could have gotten them inside the house.
Got it.
Is that go ahead.
And I was going to say, and that could have happened within that first 6 to 8 hours. That necessarily didn't have to happen 24 or 48 hours down the road. That could have happened within a close proximity of time.
Just making the decision, getting the paperwork, getting a judge to sign off on it, search warrant, bam, we're inside.
Yes.
I would think that would be protocol, like a SOP. Hey, we have to do this. So the investigators have all control. No, we're not doing it. And there's nobody checking and balances. Mm-hmm. Like they're just,
you're absolutely right. And I try to remind people that we get fixated on what happens in court, mm-hmm. but the extension of the court is the actual investigation. And, mm-hmm. and I don't mean to state the obvious, but it's critical to get it right from jump.
Yeah.
It's critical to make sure that you've crossed your T's and dotted your I's.
Absolutely.
Right from the beginning, as opposed to interviewing these witnesses towards the end of the investigation, prior to going to trial and seeing if the DA is going to bring a case forward. So again, Attorney Jackson and Unetti are going to be all over that mm-hmm. in order to create that reasonable doubt.
100%.
Mm. So is Trooper No, your last name is
McGee.
So Trooper McGee, they call you and tell you we have a body on the lawn. What would be your first steps when you show up on the scene?
The way we work any crime scene here in Massachusetts, whether it's a murder investigation, whether it's an arson, it's called a team concept. Mm-hmm. The only difference within the fire marshal's office is we work very closely with firefighters that were trained as investigators. So we would work in tandem, and as a team, someone might be assigned to establishing the crime scene, meaning wrapping the crime tape around the area in question. Someone else might be assigned to collection of evidence. Someone else might be assigned to getting witness interviews. Someone else might be assigned to going to the neighbors' houses. Someone else might be assigned to capturing any digital forensics, such as cell phone data, such as doorbell, ring camera data. There's your team effort.
Got it.
You capture all of this information and you come back, you huddle up. What do we got? What needs to go to crime lab for analysis? Mm-hmm. That photograph, bag, tag, documented on en route to the crime lab. Mm-hmm. That's an investigation.
Yeah.
Who do we need to follow up with? Now we got all this information. Mm-hmm. Where does it lead us to? Hey, we've got someone that we like for this crime. Let's re-interview them. Mm-hmm. Who are they with? Mm-hmm. Let's understand. And now you get into the forensics of things. Let's get a warrant for their cell phone to corroborate their story. Who did they say that they were with? Mm-hmm. I never left the house. Okay, well, we're going to check the cell phone towers at your residence that's on the other side of the city to make sure that you weren't transient.
Got it.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you just start peeling back the layers, mm-hmm. but the evidence is going to take you in a direction. If you hit a dead end, you take a step back. Mm-hmm. What did we miss?
Yep.
So it's a process. Everything is a process.
Yeah.
And I can see that they didn't have a team. They had 2 to 3 guys trying to take pictures, take evidence, interview people, question the ambulance. They were spread thin, and really it seemed like they weren't even trying to reach out and get more guys. They stuck with their little three-man team and missed everything because they were asking Link and there's Link, what's his
Gallagher?
Name? Gallagher. Uh-huh. And they were asking them about pictures. They were like, they were trying to save his life. We were trying to save his life, yeah. So we weren't even trying to even think about pictures. But if you had a team, this guy or gal would have been taking pictures. As that's happening, like you said, the other teammate is here interviewing, but they missed all those points.
And to that point, and the point that you're making about people being responsible for certain things, what was wild was to hear Trooper Proctor and Tully mm-hmm. go from the crime scene, take evidence from the crime scene, put it in the trunk, drive out to Karen Reed's parents' house, mm-hmm. then drive to, and then when they got there, because stuff was wet, they just put it on some construction paper to allow it to dry. But I'm like, you guys transported this in your trunk from one location, the crime scene location, to another location. You're there for a while talking to her, confiscating her phone, getting her car towed. You go from there, it's still in the trunk. From there, then you go to the police station. What is happening? How come there's no one else available to take evidence, which you just imagine needs to be cared for and carefully taken care of and like preserved in a way that there's no contamination, and it's in y'all trunk.
And you got the cups from a neighbor.
Yeah, absolutely. And the word that you just used is what's important is preserved. Mm-hmm. That's exactly the point. You can always open a sealed evidence bag and test it or examine it, whatever you need to do, but it's got to be preserved first. Mm-hmm. One thing that they did do correctly was they brought out the CERT team. If you can remember, they were talking about how the crime scene was so condensed, because you're only talking about a residential property was the crime scene, mm-hmm. that the troopers, and let me say this, the CERT team are the best in the business. We had a high profile case here in Massachusetts called Molly Bish. She was a missing person, and I had a chance to work with the CERT team as an additional set of eyes and ears. But they're the experts in any type of searching of things or for people.
Okay.
And they were described as standing shoulder to shoulder, mm-hmm. because the footprint of the property was so small based on the amount of resources, human resources they had. And so that there was additional tail lens, plastic tail lens material found on the property, I just, that doesn't sit well with me.
I'm happy you said that. Yeah, you have this expert team and shoulder to shoulder searching, and y'all just keep finding tail light stuff.
That's right.
Weeks after, people are just driving by and they're like, hey, is that red? That's red tail light. That doesn't even make sense.
Yeah.
Snow or not, that doesn't make sense.
To be spotting evidence as you drive by in your vehicle, as if you have an eagle's eye view. That was ridiculous.
Hard to believe.
I have two more questions, and then we will let you go because we've taken up a ton of your time, and this has been amazing. You've talked about bagging evidence, securing it, writing a name. Can you talk about chain of custody, I think is the proper, like what that looks like? So it's secured and it's put away, and then somebody comes in and needs to do something with it, and then they put it back. Like, what does that look like? What is the process? And can you just help us walk through what chain of custody is?
Let me reverse engineer it to go with kind of a visual from your memory. Can you remember when Trooper Proctor and some of the other witnesses were on the stand and they pulled out bags of evidence?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
That's your end state.
Okay.
Now let's go back to the beginning when the crime scene's established. You have a body that's transported to the hospital. You don't quite know if you have a criminal investigation or is it an accidental investigation of some sort. So you're still sorting through those aspects of things. But the original process of identification means photograph first, mm-hmm. so that you have some type of visual image of the evidence in its original state.
Got it.
Mm.
That is, you can't skip that step. That is essential before it's collected, put into an evidence bag, sealed evidence bag, mm-hmm. and then labeled. Date, time, location, who collected it, what is it? All that information on the form is listed out. And then from there, it's placed in a different bag in your sterile paper bag. That's now sealed, documented, same information. Mm-hmm. Transported to the crime lab, because you may have a crime analyst, could be a medical examiner that may be looking at that evidence. Maybe it's clothing. Or meaning they're going to pull DNA from it, or maybe it's the crime lab folks that are going to do the same process. So all of that continuity from collection to securing at the crime lab, mm-hmm. then the crime lab has its own set of protocols. I can't speak to their process, but they have their own internal protocols to make sure they don't break the chain of custody.
Got it. Mm-hmm.
And that they consider themselves a link, right? Because mm-hmm. you're establishing links as the term chain. You're establishing links, and all of those links cannot be broken. Hmm. And then the final link is in the courtroom. And that's when the judge, the jury, with disclosure, both the defense and the prosecution have had a chance to understand what evidence is being introduced in the trial.
Got it. Got it. Helpful. Go ahead.
This is jump into a whole nother situation. I was wondering, do you have a dog?
you might hear Angel in the background.
You do?
Yeah.
What type of dog do you have?
A Beagle mix. She was a rescue from South Carolina.
Oh, cool. So just like the Albert's dog.
Chloe.
Your dog was a rescue animal as well.
Yes.
At any point in time, does your dog bark or anything like that when you have visitors that pull up into the driveway?
Yes, sir, they do. Yes, she does.
Okay. I had to get that out before we got off because I was going to forget about it. But,
well, did you work with a canine when you were working in law enforcement?
I never was assigned to the canine unit. Okay. However, in both the fire marshal's office, to watch a canine work is amazing when they're trained for accelerants. Mm-hmm. And also at Logan Airport, we had canines. We had those Belgian Malinois. And
I know exactly.
They are amazing. They're a high energy dog. Mm-hmm. They love to work. Uh-huh. And to see them work around bomb components, even drug dogs, even to see beagles and some of the other canines that we utilize for assessing drugs coming off of bags, coming off the back carousel, people walking through, amazing to see them work.
Wow. Chloe seemed to be silent that morning, seemed to not,
70 pounds,
not react, German a German Shepherd not reacting to lights, camera, action outside, the sister coming in.
Did you hear the testimony that Chloe, they did not get rid of Chloe, that Chloe was rehomed?
Yes, rehomed. Mm-hmm.
I want somebody on the internet to confirm this. Show us Chloe. Where is she? Because I think Chloe's in the backyard. Has to be.
Oh, I just had a question. It slipped my mind.
Well, another question that I had was, I don't know if you just want to say this one for the end, but what do you think happened?
Oh, well, don't answer it yet. Okay. Hold on. Keep that one, but don't answer it yet. Because there was another question from the Patreon that I did want to address, which is, how common is it for off-duty officers to activate themselves? Of course, in this case, it's when people they know are a part of something, but I think two people in this case got on the stand and talked about I was off and then I activated myself, which I was surprising to hear for me. But is that a thing?
I will give you a specific instance when it happened and it was accepted and it was welcomed. And it was during the manhunt of the Marathon Bombers, the two Tsarnaev brothers. Mm-hmm. Then and only then, there were officers that were in close proximity in certain parts of the city of Boston, some of the suburbs, that the Tsarnaev brothers in the manhunt, those officers, we call it self-deployed. They self-deployed based on the proximity, based on most likely approval from their department supervisors. But in those exigent circumstances, extreme exigent circumstances, then it happens. In this particular case, and I can tell you that in the state police, we have policy that says that you cannot start your own investigation on your own time. It's policy. You're prohibited from doing it.
Got it.
And you could get yourself some time off if you violate that rule and regulation.
Got it. I like that. You can get yourself some time off if you choose to do it. It's going to be a little longer than you intended.
So a lot of these guys should have some time off then.
Uh-huh.
If you go back and measure the conduct against policies and procedures, I'm sure there's more violations than what's been presented.
Yeah.
We've heard that there's this federal investigation happening. I'm sure to you that was no surprise.
So for the DOJ to get involved, there has to be some level of misconduct. Now, the investigation's a mystery. There's been very little mentioned about this. We know there's one that is ongoing. I don't know what stage it's in, like most people. However, my understanding is that it just wasn't looking at the state police response, Trooper Proctor's involvement. It was also looking at the district attorney's office. Mm-hmm. And there was also rumor that the district attorney had asked for this trial to be brought forward, but in a different jurisdiction. Huh. So that could have been a trigger. And then the federal investigation took on a life of its own.
Got it.
So that is a significant in the background outcome that we're going to have a jury verdict here within the next couple of weeks.
Yeah.
That case is going to pick up where it left off.
Got it. Okay. One more question. Then we can get to Greg's. Brian Higgins, who actually I think is ATF, right? He is an ATF agent. Correct. Instead of giving his phone over to be download extracted and for the investigators and the police to look into it, he downloaded the information himself, which in my wildest dreams, I couldn't imagine if I was ever, God forbid, if I was ever a part of an investigation telling anybody that's law enforcement, it's okay, you don't got to take my phone. I'm just going to give you the pieces that I think you need. Is that not insane that he did that?
So without a doubt, 110% conflict of interest. And I heard another gentleman, retired FBI agent, had a really interesting angle. Was there additional compromising information, text messages, photographs that had nothing to do with the Karen Reed trial, but could have embarrassed him as a professional in the line of his work? That I'm just going to take whatever department sanction there is instead of this being coming out really? Made public.
Yep. Good
look
point.
Look at how detrimental Trooper Proctor's text messages from his personal phone because of the federal investigation. That's significant.
Absolutely.
I don't know in your research if you've heard something called the Brady List. And I'm going to give you a name of someone that's on the Brady List.
Okay.
But essentially, law enforcement officers, when they got themselves in trouble, would retire. And then you find them in a different jurisdiction, hired as a police officer.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
So the Brady List was established to hold government officials, not just police.
Okay.
Elected officials, county level government, police officers, election commission. So government officials.
Yeah.
But it puts them on this list. And in the instance of a police officer, if you're on this list, it's because you've compromised your integrity somewhere in the performance of your duty, which now means you're most likely not going to be a credible witness in front of judge and jury if you have to testify for anything.
Because the defense going to pull your card.
Correct.
Okay.
Now, it doesn't mean termination, but it could be that you're working within your agency, but your name appears on this list. And so essentially, anytime you go to court, the judge is not going to recognize you, or the jury's not going to recognize you as a credible source.
Got it.
Trooper Proctor's conduct is being watched by our police officers' standards that has the ability to enter names of police officers and other government officials onto that list.
Got it.
As it relates to Massachusetts. Okay. I'm going to give you one name that is on that list.
Okay.
Derek Chauvin.
Oh, well. Well, understood. Nobody nowhere is going to call him to the witness stand because that's just going to be a bad idea for everybody. Understood. Okay. That was helpful. That was good. Thank you.
Brady's List.
The Brady
List. Yes, Brady List. Yes.
Got it.
Oh, that's what's up.
All right. Now you can go to your question.
Yes. My question is, what do you think happened?
Do you have a theory?
Yeah. Do you have a theory
that you care to share?
Yeah, that you care to share.
Well, let me preface it by saying, like many people, I can't say most, because this has been such a divisive issue. You've got people that are anti-Karen Reed, pro-Karen Reed. There's been protesters in front of the courthouse. There's been witness harassment for those witnesses that have testified on behalf of the prosecutors, those people in the community of Canton, Massachusetts. So I have a unique insight because of my career, being in front of judge and jury, testifying, collecting evidence in a 24-year career. And I don't consider myself an expert in courtroom production of evidence. I don't consider myself an expert investigator. I've done it, but I've done it as an end user practitioner of the discipline. Mm-hmm. So as I mentioned earlier, my area of expertise would be the application of police use of force.
Yeah.
And has a police officer acted in their conduct excessively in the form of making an arrest? That's my world, and that's where I want to make sure I'm very clear on.
That's your, use of force.
Yes, use of force in what we call the force continuum. So to answer the question, I know what didn't happen.
Okay. Oh, I like it.
There is no evidence that shows Karen Reed struck John O'Keefe with her vehicle.
Yeah.
Okay.
We talked about this early on. It's worthy of repeating. A 7,300-pound vehicle, as testified by Trooper Paul, did not impact John O'Keefe in that there are no additional signs of trauma to his body. Mm-hmm. Bruising, fractures, broken bones, all absent. The injury that may have been a part of expiring is the gash to the back of the head. Could that have happened from falling in the pavement? It was asked by Attorney Yannetti today, would it be possible to be punched in the face, knocked out before you hit the ground, and your head impacting the ground to create that type of damage? And a medical examiner said it's possible. So we don't have it. I don't want to land on an absolute theory or create a theory without absolutes, because the experts, the true experts that testified, haven't given us anything more than possibilities.
Yeah, that's true.
But I can rule out what didn't happen.
Yes.
That's a fact.
I like it.
That's my answer.
You gonna take his answer?
So for your audience, though, and I think this is important, because a lot of people are like, nope, I'm standing hard on my, and again, I respect anyone's opinion.
Sure.
But you have to take in account of all of the factors. You can't turn a blind eye. I can't ignore the fact that there were tail lens found on John O'Keefe's body. But then I have to measure that against the lack of trauma that his body doesn't appear to have.
Right.
That's more credible for me to lean towards the vehicle didn't strike him.
Understood. And even in that analysis, thinking about, to the point that you're making, the investigation, even with the evidence we have and the way that we have it, how credible is that based on the crime scene was lifted early, stuff was in the back of people's trunks, there was red tail light found weeks after. So, you know, it's like all of that, when you put that picture together, it just don't, number the math ain't math.
Here are your four outcomes. A mistrial, that means the DA could start this whole baby all over again. Don't see it happening, but she could be retried. Acquittal, neither innocent or guilty, but she cannot be retried. And then, of course, you have a not guilty finding or a guilty finding, all coming back from the jury. But one juror, all you need to do is to create reasonable doubt in one juror.
With she's found innocent, let's say she's found innocent, how do you find out, or how do you try somebody else other than her? Because similar to like the OJ case, how, you know, no one was ever arrested for that murder. Could that happen here?
There could be another look. I don't want to say a full-blown investigation. Maybe they could go back and search the house. But now, I mean, this was January 2022.
Yeah.
Right? So the Alberts have since sold the home. There's another family in that home. I think for that to happen, they would have to get a search warrant in the home and try to recreate, almost reverse engineer what might have happened on theory. But that's a lot of resources. And I'm glad you brought up the OJ trial, because this is kind of, there's a lot of similarities here. First and foremost, we know that O.J. Simpson was extremely successful, had a tremendous professional athlete career, did very well in his afterlife as a celebrity, and had the means to hire high-profile attorneys like Johnny Cochran, had the means to hire Kardashian, attorney Kardashian, right? He had, again, they call them the dream team, right? These were the the best of the best out in LA in order to bring a defense against a murder trial. Karen Reed also has means. If she had a public defender, this trial would have been over 3 weeks ago and probably wouldn't be the outcome that she was looking for. That's the first parallel.
Yep.
Next parallel. Trooper Proctor's testimony. Attorney Jackson, very smartly, you know, it was hard listening to those vulgar, misogynistic statements. From his text messages. And I'm sure y'all saw that when the judge said, "These are your words, Trooper Proctor. You can't spell out derogatory."
You got to say it because you said it before.
Exactly. Right. So, but what Attorney Jackson did smartly was he connected bias to it. Right. He didn't just stay on the vulgar side of things.
Yeah.
His point was, you were biased right from the beginning of this investigation.
Yep.
You took in this policy and procedure that says any business of the state police is confidential. It should not be communicated. So that's a violation of one of our policies and procedures to begin with.
Got it.
That being said, the parallel back to OJ trial is that Mark Furman. Mark Furman in the trial was identified as a biased investigator. That's the next connection.
Yeah.
I'm going to give you another one, and I'm going to stop with this third one because I can go on more. Van Nader, I believe his name. He was one of the LAPD's responding officers.
Wow.
If you can remember the evidence, now again, the evidence in the OJ trial was horrible. It was a tremendous bloody murder scene.
Yeah.
He collected the evidence and took it home that night. Do y'all remember that?
I don't remember. I didn't know that.
I don't, but that's wild.
Think about that.
What? Yeah.
He took the evidence home. He didn't take it to the crime lab. So now you talked earlier about the chain of custody.
Yes. Yep.
You have compromised evidence.
Yes.
He broke that link. Yeah.
At your house.
Broken link.
He broke the link.
Wow. That's insane.
Can't make it up.
No. So I'm saying I'm not a lawyer. That obviously is the name of my platform, but I get so fascinated with these trials and cases, not only because of the education. I feel like it's good to know and understand like what the process is, how it happens. All of that is very informative and we should know it as a people, culture, all of that. But it's also wild. So many pieces of it. When you start to really understand what happens, what you think it happens, what you expect to be happening, and then you find out it's completely not like that. People were taking evidence home. They had it in the trunk. People were looking in her phone. Proctor's sending ridiculous messages to his childhood friend. When you start to hear that stuff, you're just in shock. Like, wait, this is happening? This is crazy. This is people's freedom. This is their lives at stake. And so when you start, that kind of stuff gets uncovered. It's wild.
You know, there's
a high standard and then they disappoint you.
That's exactly it. And you know, John O'Keefe, it's easy to get lost in the circus of things, but John O'Keefe and his family deserve justice.
Absolutely.
And, you know, anyone that has gone through some horrific incident, regardless if it's a simple motor vehicle stop or something as egregious as a murder situation, that due process, I mean, even Charles Manson got due process.
Yeah.
Oh, right. Man. So,
yep.
So I mean, you got to put it out there like that.
Yeah. 100%.
And to see an investigation compromised on so many different levels to so many different people that have been entered into the criminal justice system, it's disturbing, it's wrong, and it shouldn't happen.
100%.
Should not happen.
100%.
At all.
No, and I'm happy you said that because I do try to emphasize that as well. Obviously, like I said, I follow trials and cases and all of that. But at the end of the day, there are victims in these situations, you know, and John O'Keefe is not here. He lost his life as a result of this. And so while it is a circus and you're trying to keep up with all of the chaos, at the end of the day, his family members are in that courtroom and they're having to hear what was said about him. And, you know, they're having to watch and see these pictures of his body and seeing these clothes that he wore. And that is traumatic and they do deserve justice. So I think that is a perfect way to wrap us out.
Yep.
Is there anything else you wanted to say? I don't want to cut you off or anything. I just want to make sure we got everything out. Obviously, we asked all our questions, but if you had anything else.
No, just that, you know, I appreciate being on your show and you covering the story, because not everyone is getting, and again, I don't want to pretend that I'm sitting in the courtroom every day. But again, I have unique insights and I understand the process of not 100%, but of a lot of the things. And I shared in full transparency, there are some things that confused me as well as evidence was being introduced and some of the technical aspects of like the cell phone data and the forensics of things around that stuff, GPS mapping data and how iOS operates. That stuff was a heavy lift to listen to the experts share their opinion. But I'm glad you're covering this story. I'm glad I had the chance to hopefully provide some insight to your audience and your platform. And I'd love to talk with you both on the next opportunity. We know, God forbid, there's going to be something else coming down the pipeline, but let's talk about it.
Absolutely.
Oh, you're definitely.
I know. We're like, they're already in the Patreon comments. Like, can we have him back?
You're in the Rolodex already.
Keep you on speed, dog.
Yes. Are you keeping up with the YSL drop?
That'll be great. Thank you.
Yep. No. I want to say thank you for your service, for risking your life for that many years.
Yeah.
In Massachusetts, you know, it's an honor. Yeah. You know, thank you so much.
To have you on for sure. Thank you. We will be in touch. And let me just do a closeout really quick. Okay. Thank you all for watching. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I hope you learned something from Todd McGee. He was an excellent guest on the show. So thank you again for watching. Like, subscribe, share, do all the things. Until next time. Bye.